On Monday, the 28th of September 2009, the Sydney Institute helped in the organisation of a seminar on the Rudd government's workplace reform. The seminar was hosted by the Rotary Club of North Sydney Sunrise. This podcast is a recording of the proceedings at that function.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Ted Sheehy, and I'm the president of the Rotary Club of North Sydney Sunrise. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here tonight. I think we're going to be in for a great evening and a very informative one. Just make sure there's nothing else I need to say at this stage. No, I think that I can now hand over to Kay Sinclair. And Kay is the CEO of Sinclair Consulting Group, and she'll will in turn introduce the guest speakers. Thanks very much. Thank you, Kay.
Good evening, everyone. In July of this year, obviously the Fair Work Australia Act came into play. We'll call it from now on the FWA. It replaced the WAR Act and brought in the NES, NAPSA, the FWO, and replaced the AIRC, AIRE, WA, WA, ASPCS, and not surprising many of us in the SME space think it's just all hard BS. However, the legislation is starting to have an impact, and I apologise to my legal colleagues. So I'll just give you a little insight into what happened today, for example, on the FWO. That would be the Fair Work Online site. So we have the Pay Protector, who is now, you can imagine him, the superhero, helps underpaid tweed head journalists secure $10,000 back pay, $15,500 in fines to Perth company for taking 2 years to pay severance pay. A Melbourne company will face court for allegedly victimising two of its workers after they complained about being underpaid. The watchdogs will target the Royal Easter show, or sorry, the Royal Melbourne show, to stop exploitation of workers. Beware of where you're buying your berry sauce this year. And the watchdog probes maternity discrimination. So, as you can see, it's starting to affect just about everybody. Tonight, I am pleased to have an esteemed panel of experts to break down some of the new legislation. So firstly, I introduce Joy Deepore from Harmer's Workplace Lawyers. Joy Deep has a Master's of Law from Sydney University and is a fellow of the Australian Human Resources Institute. What we thought we'd do first up is to give everyone just a 5-minute introduction to what they can see as being part or what is this new legislation, and then we'll break it down for you later on. Joy Deep is recognised throughout the human resources industry as a leading expert. And I'll now invite Joy Deep to give a 5-minute summary of his key points regarding Fair Work Australia.
Stand in front of walking.
What is your name? I don't know whether your thing will pick you up.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming along. In 5 minutes, it's very difficult to do justice to what is something like 2,000 pages of legislation that keeps lawyers like myself amused in our idle hour. But I think it's very important for everyone here to appreciate that what we're talking about is not some new fad that's just been brought in for the sake of it. We're talking about some of the most radical changes to the way in which people work in this country. We're talking about legislation that has changed, perhaps forever, the way in which employers and unions will interact. It's changed the framework under which people can be employed and the rules of the game, certainly from an employer perspective. We all know that when work choices were introduced, it caused a fair ruckus amongst the community. We all know that politically it was very ambitious legislation, and some of the piece of legislation was the downfall of the last government. We're all entitled to have views about whether it was or wasn't. What we do know is that this legislation very much seeks to address the wrongs or perceived wrongs of the work choices legislation. My son was having his 3-year-old birthday party yesterday, and we were talking about pensions. And My son was asking me, and I was sort of asking him perhaps more appropriately, why is it that when a pendulum might be up here, you can't just give it one push and it lands in the middle? It's exactly the same thing with this legislation. Don't believe the rhetoric. This is not balanced legislation. I say that not to be critical, but it isn't balanced. The true imbalance of this legislation will only be borne out over the next 12 to 18 months. Employers will learn, in a lot of instances, the hard way. We know that the union movement, in terms of what they've said, is that the legislation doesn't go far enough. So certainly from their perspective, there's not as much balance in the legislation as they would like. So there's a lot of challenges. There's a lot of challenges for employers, a lot of challenges for unions, and a lot of challenges for employees. Some of the things that you will see a lot of in the next 12 to 18 months are testing of the new good faith bargaining laws. Employers now being forced to talk to unions. They can't tell them to go away anymore. Some might say that that's long overdue. How employers respond to that will be very interesting. How far the union movement push these newfound privileges will also be interesting, and they've got a lot of decisions to make at their end. Because if they are seen to be pushing it too far, that will give a lot of reality to the rhetoric from some of the more concerned employers out there. The way in which businesses engage contractors and consultants is something that is now going to be more tightly regulated. The whole issue of human rights in the workplace is going to be more tightly regulated. And as with any new legislation, you're going to see a lot of test cases. You're going to see, as we already have, and as Kay highlighted in terms of today's press and news, a lot of action from the Fair Work Ombudsman, prosecuting employers who have done the wrong thing. Some of those prosecutions are entirely warranted. Some of them might not have happened under the old legislation, even though they could have happened. Why is there going to be a spike in that activity? Well, because the legislation is new and the legislation needs to bear its teeth. So you will see a lot of very interesting things happen over the next 12 to 18 months, and all of that will happen in the lead up to the next election. And the Coalition's stance in relation to this piece of legislation has been deafeningly silent throughout the whole process in the Senate where this legislation is being tested. You hardly heard a peep from any of the opposition senators of any significance yet. Perhaps that silence, or perhaps a whole range of things, has led to what I've often referred to now as an uncomfortable space, particularly for employers. So with that very brief introduction, I'll hand back to Kay, and I look forward to hearing what Mark and Dick have to say as well.
Thank you, Julian. As I said, what we're going to do is just give everyone a 5-minute summary, and then we're actually going to go into some more of the points, obviously, that Georgie touched on, and some of which we're all very passionate about. So our next panellist, to give his 5-minute summary, is Dick Rosier, who is a partner of New South Wales Business Chamber, one of the largest business organisations. It has a membership of over 5,000 member companies and 23,000 associate members.
Thank you, Kay, and thank you very much for the invitation to be here tonight. I guess for my 5 minutes, what I'd like to do is briefly look at the way in which I think what Kay sort of alluded to, the Fair Work system, is going to impact on employers. What are most employers going to notice about the system? I think the first thing, and Joyde alluded to this, is that the process of getting from where we were to the Fair Work system is complicated. There was, in fact, a piece of legislation which came into effect in March of last year, which started the process to Fair Work. There are now 3 other acts in place, plus regulations, and there's another act yet to be passed, plus its regulations. So there's a massive amount of legislation there. So it's reasonably complicated when you start to look at the detail of things. The second thing is that the process to the Fair Work system is complicated. Kay suggested that from the 1st of July it was here, and that's almost true, but not quite true. What's actually happening is that most of the system started on the 1st of July. Some of the system doesn't start until the 1st of January. So most of the features about bargaining and union rights and unfair dismissals and those sorts of things are now in place. What's not there are the modern awards and the national employment standards. They don't start until the 1st of July. So not only have we moved from one system to another, but we're now in an uncomfortable bridging period where some things don't yet apply but will apply from the 1st of January, and some of those will affect things which are going on now. So the first thing is, it's a bit complicated. The second thing about the Fair Work system is that the focus really is on bargaining. And again, Joy Deep alluded to this. But unlike any legislation we've had before, the Fair Work legislation is oriented to the promotion of bargaining. The last form of the Workplace Relations Act encouraged bargaining, encouraged individual agreement making, but that could be done formally or informally. The Fair Work system is right on about collective agreement making. Eventually it will no longer be possible to have individual agreements from the 1st of January. But there are processes in the system where employers can be required to bargain or ordered to comply with good faith bargaining requirements. So unlike any other legislation, employers are being involved in bargaining and can be compelled to be. Initially, as we've seen, it's going to be the usual sorts of employers and unions who are involved in, if you like, setting the terms of the legislation in the tribunal. But over time, bargaining will come into workplaces where it has not typically been part of how things are done. The third feature of the legislation is that there are significantly increased protections for employees. The national employment standards are more pervasive and cover a wider range of employment conditions and are more prescriptive than the equivalents under the Workplace Relations Act, which, because we're in the bridging period, continue to apply for the moment. Modern awards will be more prescriptive and cover a wider range of matters than did federal awards under the previous system. There is also a set of general protections, and this is a very comprehensive set of rights for the various actors in the industrial system against untoward behaviour by one or other of the other actors in the system. It sort of builds on the old freedom of association, discrimination provisions, unlawful termination provisions, but makes them much more comprehensive and generalised. So this is another feature of the new system. There's also increased protection for the low paid in the new system. First of all, there will be very few exceptions from award coverage. Virtually all, if not all, employees who are low paid will be subject to a modern award when they come into effect. Secondly, there's a special low paid bargaining stream where Fair Work Australia can interact with bargaining and compel bargaining where employees are low paid and there's no tradition of bargaining in the past. Thirdly, there are proposed to be annual wage reviews. There must be a minimum wage decision each year. Award wages and agreement wages can't fall below the minimum wage, and the conditions that the Fair Work Australia takes into account when reviewing wages are different from those that the Fair Pay Commission took into account when reviewing statutory minimum wages. So it is highly unlikely that we will ever see a nil result in the annual wage review either. And finally, the fourth distinctive feature of the new legislation is that there is a significantly new balance between work and other obligations on employees. There are significant changes to parental leave, there is a new right to request flexible working arrangements, and even individual local arrangements, flexibility arrangements, are subject to the employee being better off overall if such an arrangement is reached. So, in summary, there are four significant impacts from the new legislation. The first is its complication and the complication of its introduction. The second is the significant bargaining focus in the new legislation. The third is significant new and wider protections for employees. And the fourth is a new balance between work and non-work obligations for employees. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think Dick probably summarised it up very well in saying that there are very active on stage here and we don't have a member of the government, which is probably the fourth person that we're missing. However, we do have our final panellist, Mark Lennon, who represents the union movement. So he is the Secretary of Unions New South Wales. He has had vast experience in the union movement as an organiser, trainer, an industrial officer, and now as secretary. I now invite Mark to give his 5-minute summary on his version of the new legislation.
Well, thanks very much for that. Thanks very much to the Rugby Club for the invitation to address the meeting tonight. It's funny, my last experience in this hall was when my son was appearing at a school concert. A few years ago, 7-year-old, and it was a 30-degree November Sunday afternoon where all the parents were sweating. The concert went for 2 hours and everyone's child in 5 minutes. I think we've all been there, you might know it. And I was one of the many fathers down the back jostling with the various cameras trying to get the best shot for the child. But right now, here we are, it's September, it's quite cold, so I can't tell. But the thing with the legislation, first and foremost, is if you recall the campaign that was run over the last couple of years with regard to the choice of legislation, it was all about your rights at work. And if you look at the new legislation, it's not union legislation. It's not restoring unions to key institutional players in our industrial relations system. It is giving individuals certain rights. It's giving them rights, as you heard from Jordan, various rights based on freedom of association and other nations. Sure, there is a role for unions to play in the system, and there's no doubt that there is an enhanced role for unions to play in the system compared to work choices. But is that the implication of individuals? That's the other key element of this that we must be aware of. For instance, when it comes to collective bargaining now, you have as an employer a right to a bargaining representative. Now in most cases, we'll be honest, that would be a union, of course. Where people have got a union or where unions have a strong presence in the workplace, then the union will be a bargaining representative. But it doesn't necessarily have to be. And there's no different streams of collective agreements. There used to be union agreements and non-union agreements. Now there's just a collective agreement or an enterprise agreement. So for instance, in the role of New South Wales, where she's strongly been unionised, there's about 80-90% of the workers there are unionised, they're now about to embark on negotiations for a collective agreement. And what has happened is the employer has informed the employees of their right to have a bargaining representative, and they've been told the employees that if the union, if there is a union, then they don't have to do anything, the union will just be their bargaining representative. But 17 of the employees have informed the railways that they want someone else other than the union to be the bargaining representative. So technically, the union plus the 17 different bargaining representatives are meant to appear at the table, which I think is a problem in itself. One of them allegedly, and this might be urban myth, but it's a good story, allegedly one employee says that he wants to count a priest to represent in the bargaining. So, and it could make some of the decision, interesting negotiations going forward. So I think the key message that I've come across with the legislation is that even though this, as Dick's pointed out, Jordan has pointed out, the key element of workplace conditions are now contained in collective agreements, be they a bond award or be they a collective agreement. We still have the 10 NES standards, which just simply apply to individuals, whether they're covered by an award or not. We also have, regardless of the fact that we no longer have individual contracts under legislation, just remember in this country that about 30% of employees have individual contracts anyway, because they're under common law agreements, they don't have an award covering or any other sort of collective instrument agreement covering them, and I don't see that changing substantially. There will be no doubt increased negotiation and collective bargaining, but collective bargaining, no matter what the law says, doesn't lend itself to every situation, in every employment situation, in every workplace. When you have, and we also have it in Australia these days, 30% of our employees in part-time, temporary, or casual employment. But that sort of workforce, in those areas, it's very difficult to get up a collective agreement. So we won't see sweeping changes to the way our workplaces are regulated, or the sort of industrial instruments that are in place in our workplaces. We also need some significant change, but I don't think that fundamentally there's the whole system or the whole way that our workplaces operate have been turned on the head. Sure, certainly the first time in this country we have collective bargaining rights, that is a significant step forward. The issue is how well they can be implemented or how widely those collective bargaining rights can be implemented. So I think there's more questions from the legislation than answers. It's going to be the first couple of months. There's just been some teething problems that have arisen with the legislation. I do agree with your idea that the next 4 months will probably be the most interesting time as regards to implementation of the legislation. But if I say this, the public at large, I think the issue's over. Most people, their key concern when it came to the work choices legislation was the removal of unpaid dismissal rights, and what they perceive as the ability of employers to move on to individual contracts and therefore cut conditions. They're both gone as far as the public at large is concerned. Well, they're both fixed those two issues and therefore the issue is over. So I don't know if whatever else happens with the workplace relations in this country over the next 4 or 5 or 6 years will be very much an argument amongst the practitioners and the insiders rather than the public at large. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark. What we're going to do now is introduce a few topics that the speakers are going to discuss, and no doubt some will be heated. And unfortunately for me, I get to choose the first one. So I'm going to steer clear of the union movement for now, and possibly go back to what might be a bit safer, and probably something that anyone who's in a small to medium enterprise business area would be worried about, which is your right to terminate or to make a redundancy. And some of you may know, I'm in the recruitment industry, and we have a variety of clients from one of the top 500s down, right down to somebody who just employs one person. And this is something that's very dear to all of them. If this person goes off the rails, what do I do? And do I have rights? And so I guess now I'd like to probably hand over to Joy D just to discuss what the legal side of that is, and then probably go on to Dick and then over to Mark from there just to discuss termination and redundancy and what the new legislation actually does cover.
Thank you for this. Look, I think the area of unfair dismissal has changed fairly significantly, and there's two main areas where there's been change. Firstly, I guess to pick up on the question of, well, when can you sack someone? It's fair enough, and as Mark observed, under work choices, employers had a lot of free rein to dismiss employees. Certainly if you had 100 or fewer employees, you met the definition of a so-called small business. Now, I think regardless of your political persuasion, to say that if you employ 99 people, you're a small business is ridiculous. So what that meant was that to have an exclusion of employers who employed 100 or fewer employees being exempted or excluded from an unfair dismissal claim meant that there was something like 35 or 40% of the Australian working population, as I understand it, that couldn't bring unfair dismissal claims. Now, that number has now been reduced to a far more appropriate number, if we're talking genuinely about assisting small businesses, to what will for a while be 15 sort of full-time equivalent and then 15 headcount. But that number of 15 is probably more spot-on in terms of what's a small business. But I think the other... So that was the big ticket change from work choices, but that wasn't the only one. I think some of the other ones have probably been swept a little bit under the radar because of the significance of the big ticket change. It's fair to say now that outside of the first 6 months of an employee's employment, the opportunity to remove someone from your organisation, if you are above that magic 15 number, is severely curtailed. In fact, you will have to have... you'll have to prove that the reason you've dismissed that person is for reasons of genuine redundancy. So once their first 6 months has passed, they're very much in the game. When you can prove that you no longer wish the position that that person was performing to be performed by anyone, and it's a very high threshold, then you'll be able to satisfy the genuine redundancy exclusion. The other issue is that when it comes to things like dealing with poor performance or perceived poor performance, the fact that there's greater accessibility to unfair dismissal claims means that employers have to very much get that right. The myth in Australia that you have to give people three warnings before you can remove them from employment. It's like baseball making its way into industrial relations into this country. It's never been the case. You do have to, however, go through a fair, considered process, as is everyone's human right. But a lot of employers will be challenged by that. Work choices have made a lot of employers a bit too relaxed around the need to properly and fairly performance manage. The second side of the whole dismissal equation, which flows from the redundancy, is that from 1 January next year, all employees in Australia will, regardless of whether they're award covered or not, have a right to redundancy pay. It's a scale that ranges from 4 weeks up to 16 weeks' pay. It's a sliding scale. But regardless of whether that's written into your contract or whether you've got a redundancy policy or whether there's an award or agreement that applies to you, that is your minimum severance pay entitlement, regardless of your remuneration level. That's going to be a pretty significant dollar cost for employers as well. For a lot of employers out there, sure, they've got 3 weeks or 4 weeks per year of service, and for them, they won't bat an eyelid at that scale. But for a lot of employers, that's going to be a pretty heavy burden. It doesn't apply to those employers who have 15 or fewer employees, so there's some assistance there for small businesses, and perhaps so rightly so. So they're the two areas where I think there's been significant change, but employers need to just dust off the rule books around dismissing people from what was in place 4 or 5 years ago, because that's very much alive and kicking once again.
Thank you, Jordan. So, again, from an employer perspective, what do you do? Without having to spend thousands of dollars on JoyDeep, I guess, is what everyone wants to know. Sorry, JoyDeep.
Maybe I should just address one thing that JoyDeep was sort of taking for granted in his answer, and then try to answer Kay's question, which is more complicated. The new system of unfair dismissal doesn't exempt employers depending on their size. There are no exemptions for employers. It does, however, as Jody suggested, treat employers differently according to their size, so that there are slightly different rules for employers with fewer than 15 employees than there are for employers with 15 or more employees. The first different rule is the length of time. It's called a minimum employment period, but perhaps easier to think of as a probation period, is different for the two groups of employers. A small employer has a probation period with a new employee of 12 months, a larger employer, 6 months. So to the extent that an employer is realising that a new employee is not working out, obviously that is something which needs to be borne in mind. The second sort of difference between small employers and larger employers is the standard which would be brought to assessing an unfair dismissal claim. In the case of a small employer, there is something which is available on the Fair Work online site that Kay referred to earlier on, called the Small Business Fair Dismissal Code. And it, in one page, tries to set out appropriate behaviour if an employer, a small employer, is contemplating a termination. So it deals with the right to make someone redundant if the job that the person is doing is no longer required to be done in the company, and it also deals with terminating someone for reasons of capacity or conduct. And in that case, the small business employer has to have shown that they discussed the problem with the employee, gave the employee an opportunity to respond and also to improve whatever the performance issue was that might require training or something like that. It also provides for summary termination if the behaviour of the employee has been outrageous, the employee has been fighting or done something which threatens health and safety within the company or something like that, or has stolen things. But the standards there are fairly high. If an employer believes that someone should be dismissed summarily, the standard of wrongdoing is relatively high. It is, if it were, for example, for theft, it is akin to something which is potentially reportable to police. You would not be obliged to do that, but that is the sort of standard that Fair Work Australia would bring to an issue like that. If the employer is a larger employer, that is 15 or more employees, then the dismissal, if challenged, needs to comply with the requirements of the Act. And the first thing is that it needs to have been for a proper type of reason, either because the work is not required to be done by anyone, so that job is disappearing, and we'll come back to redundancy in a second, or because of something involving the employee's capacity or conduct. And Fair Work Australia will inquire into whether the employee has been advised of this, what remedial response was attempted, how that went, how the employee responded to the problem in the first place. Was the employee allowed to bring someone along to support them to key interviews or the key interview? Those sorts of things. So we are back to an unfair dismissal regime, particularly for larger employers, which is reminiscent of the one that existed some years ago in the federal system. There is no balancing of whether or not it was a fair go all round. That is not in the new legislation. There is recognition of capacity on the part of an employer. If it is a smaller employer, no specialist HR, then the standard which will be applied to process will be lower than if there is a specialist HR function or if it is a larger employer. So those sorts of factors will be taken into account. There's no doubt that the result is, as Joydeep suggested, that employers really do have to think about what they're doing much more carefully than particularly 100 employers of 100 or fewer did in the past. In the case of redundancy, the standard has changed somewhat as well, and it is important to point that out. It is perfectly valid to terminate someone if the job that they're doing is no longer required, provided that you've done one or two other things. And the first is that if an award or an agreement applies to that employee and there are consultation provisions with respect to change, for example, then they need to have been complied with. And the second is, was it reasonable in all the circumstances of the company and the redundant position not to redeploy the person somewhere else in the business? So if those sorts of, if the consultation provisions have not been followed, or no sensible investigation of redeployment has taken place, then it is not a genuine redundancy and it is most likely an unfair dismissal. So there's no doubt it is harder than it used to be. As Joydeep pointed out, when the national employment standards commence, there will be a much wider right to a minimum redundancy standard. I should point out one other thing with respect to termination, and that is that when the national employment standards commence, there will also be an obligation on an employer who is terminating an employee to give that employee written notice no later than the date of termination. So this doesn't apply in the case of a summary termination, but for most terminations, apart from those which are the completion of a contract of one kind or another, if the employer is terminating the employee, there will also be an obligation to give the employee written notice of that termination.
Thank you. Now, can I just say, if any of you start saying NES as NCIS by the end of the night, that's fine, because it does sort of sound a bit same. I just, before we actually go on to Mark to get a union rebuttal, sorry Mark, I just think we need a bit of a legal hearing on what is an unlawful termination versus what is unfair dismissal, because I think a lot of small businesses are very confused about those two, and they get bandied about a lot, and there are two very, very distinct things. Can you expand on that, please?
Sure. The main distinction is that an unfair dismissal is one that has historically evolved through being considered to be one that is harsh, unjust, or unreasonable. So, for example, that someone wasn't given an opportunity to improve their performance, there was misconduct that they were alleged to have engaged in and that wasn't properly investigated. There was inconsistent treatment amongst employees who'd engaged in the same type of conduct. These would all be examples of potential unfair dismissal. Unlawful dismissal or unlawful termination, which is accessible to a far greater range of people because the certain other exclusions around, for example, remuneration don't apply, arise when someone has been dismissed for a prohibited reason. For example, they were dismissed because they took a period of parental leave. They were dismissed because they were considered to be too old. They were dismissed because of a particular racial background that they came from. They're a member of a trade union. They have a particular political preference. They've engaged in industrial action. So there are a whole list of these reasons that are deemed to be unlawful grounds of termination. And naturally, from an employer's point of view, to dismiss someone and be alleged to have done so unlawfully, even leave aside the legal technicalities around it, carries with it a far greater damage, reputation damage, I think, to organisations than being seen to have been unfair.
Thank you. Sorry, Mark. Sorry to interrupt, because I'm sure you've got a lot of sense from the union's perspective here.
Well, just as I said, it might be remarks, clearly, or between the large, they felt there should be a restoration of unfair dismissal rights. The problem with the legislation that exists in private workforces, and everyone admit this, that a lot of the dismissals were all revolving around processes opposed to the substantive issues about whether there was a fair go all around with the actual dismissal. And the government has been at lots of pains to try and overcome that with its new legislation, and it's also trying to facilitate processes that are quicker when it comes to unfair dismissals. So we have a situation where you can have these telephone conciliations with unfair dismissals, which I must say, early days, yet some of my union colleagues are a bit concerned about. But the real test will be what are the outcomes and results of unfair dismissal claims, because basically what happened previously was we had this compensation up to 6 months, which we now have here in the Fair Work legislation. If you get compensation, if you've been dismissed unfairly, with up to 6 months' pay. And we had this scenario where it sort of became a system, to be honest, everyone knew that you might offer 4 weeks when you terminated someone and then they came back with an unfair dismissal claim and there's a bit of argument bargaining, and I'm probably paying them 8 weeks. And that was sort of a practice, some variation thereof. And it ended up with this system of people saying they have to pay go away money. So we want the system to retain some integrity. That's what you want. And as long as the system retains some integrity, then I think it will hold up. But it's early days, and it just depends how Fair Work apply the new legislation and how they apply not just the interpretation of the law but how they apply it to practice.
So, sorry now, Mark, to put you on the spot. And I'm not quite sure if Yvonne had this in mind when she stuck me in this role, but anyone will tell you I'm a fairly opinionated person. I think everyone would love to know. One of the things that I've been really interested to know is exactly what will happen if you do dismiss someone, and if they do lodge a claim, because that has indeed changed quite dramatically, hasn't it? There is now a new system that there is only one person, I think, who hears your claim. Is this correct? And you're not allowed legal representation. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you caught me now on detail, the technical detail.
No,
I understand. The present situation, as I understand it, the first step is conciliation, and it will be done over the telephone. And the conciliator can make some recommendations. And that's caused, as I say, some concerns, because people feel very much that when it comes to the issue of unfair dismissal, that you really need to get face to face with people and try and get some resolution of the issue by having people around the table. Having said that process can happen rather quickly. It doesn't necessarily have to happen in the Industrial Relations Commission, so it can be somewhat informal, as I understand it. The other issue that seems to have changed to try and hasten the process is that during the conciliation process, some pretty strong recommendations can be made by the conciliator as to some suggestions about resolution of the actual unfair dismissal.
So perhaps we can get from the panel, because I think everyone here would love to know, in case they end up in the new system, who is it, A, that will hear your claim? Who will make a judgment? What happens if it's found against you?
I can shed some light on that, having had my first conciliation only 3 hours ago. So the process, I did it deliberately because I knew the questions about it. So,
thank you for doing that.
So my client dismissed someone from his organisation that happened to be his IT manager. The person lodged an unfair dismissal claim. That paperwork was sent to my client and they had to complete some paperwork in response to that paperwork. It was fairly short, just some basic questions around why they dismissed the individual, how they were responding to the allegations that the dismissal was unfair. We, as the company's legal representatives, filled out that paperwork on their behalf. However, interestingly, on the point about legal representation, Fair Work Australia requires the employer to, at the very least, email Fair Work Australia to indicate that they want legal representation. So it's not automatic. So that was a process that my client had to go through. The process, as Mark has referred to, was listed for a teleconference conciliation before a specialist conciliator. Now, that's not their title, but this was someone who has not been a part of the former Australian Industrial Relations Commission previously, and whose brief was to see whether the matter could be resolved.
Sorry, I haven't got a mic. So what would their qualifications be, this person?
Look, I thought it best not to ask too much about that, but they...
Are they a clerk, or...?
Oh, look, I think it's... Sorry, Mark.
Sorry, well, I was just going to say, no, they have advertised these people, and they are asking people with some industrial background experience. I know some former union officials who have applied for the job, but to be honest, knowing the telephone technique, I wouldn't go with them.
I think it's fair to assume that they will have had some experience in mediation or conciliation or dispute resolution in some way, shape or form. The process lasted for about 90 minutes. It started with the applicant, similar to how it did in the old days under the Industrial Relations Commission. The applicant, all over the telephone, indicated what he was claiming made the dismissal unfair. We responded. What was interesting, and perhaps the awkwardness of the telephone medium as opposed to a face-to-face, was then having these private conferences, which used to happen by virtue of someone stepping out of a room and then you got the opportunity for the body language and all of that to kick in. We actually hung up while the conciliator spoke to the applicant, and then the applicant hung up and then the conciliator rang us back, and then we hung up and then there was a joint session. The matter didn't settle. And I would say that the major difference was that it took a lot more time to get to the outcome we got to today than we would have under the old system. And that's ironic in that the client will probably incur more cost than less, which is a counterintuitive outcome in terms of why the process was set up in that particular way. The other thing that's lost in this opportunity is that as practitioners, and I think I think fairly confidently speak to Mark Dick and myself on this, that you get to establish relationships when you're a practitioner with members of the Commission and the Tribunal. And there's a lot that happens to actually expedite the process when you've got people who are experienced, both advocates and members of the Commission and Tribunals, where everyone's acting in their client's interests to get to a quick outcome. Now, you lose that when you bring people who are not familiar with the processes, who don't have established relationships with the people who are dealing with the matter, and I think that's why for quite some time there will be enormous inefficiencies through this new process, and I think applicants have less of a likelihood of getting an outcome that's fair to them, and I think employers will actually be incurring more costs and more inconvenience as a part of the process.
Well, you're not due to do that for a few minutes, but I'll let you do it because you're so good looking. So there you go.
Could you just expand on a definition of the body who determines these issues? You talk about them and us. Is it still a commission?
Yes.
You talk about a tribunal. Who appoints that?
Yeah.
And what are their statutory?
I think it's more you probably need to know more the person who's making this decision. And I
should have said that with the matter.
What is the statutory body that
determines? So the conciliation is not a forum for any orders to be made or formal resolution of the matter unless the parties consent to that. this particular matter serves as a good case in point. Because it didn't resolve at the conciliation, at the end of it, the conciliator said the matter will now be referred to arbitration. It will then go to a member of Fair Work Australia, which is a tribunal. All of the members of the Australian Industrial Relations Commission have been reappointed to Fair Work Australia. It's now a tribunal, not a commission. They retain much of the same powers that they had previously. I mean, there's some technical differences, but for all intents and purposes, a lot of the same powers are retained. The matter will now be heard in accordance with the timetable, as was the case for unfair dismissal claims. I think the major change to process has been this upfront conciliation process has changed quite significantly. So in answer to your question, the statutory body is Fair Work Australia. It is now an umbrella. Appointed by the government. And Fair Work Australia is now an umbrella organisation that has an investigative arm, prosecutorial arm, and a determinative arm. And there's interesting issues around how that is to be separated.
And some of those arms were the people that I mentioned beforehand that were investigating, you know, all sorts of things. You know, the people who were just in the Melbourne showground trying to sell fairy floss. So, okay. I think if we move on to the next one, well, we make it a juicy one. The right of unions to enter the workplace. I guess. To give a summary here, there is a lot of media speculation and a lot of public speculation about all of a sudden can you have the union movements appear on your front doorstep and ask to investigate your records. And I can hear a big sigh coming over here from Mark. So I guess we need to have the truth about what is... the right of the union, who can invite the union in, and what rights the employers have to say, no, you cannot enter the workplace at this time. So we'll go over to Mark first, actually.
Well, as you know, I think Jordan said in his introductory remarks that there are some people that legislation and the unions aren't happy with, and I think this is one. A lot of what applied when it came to right of entry in the work choices legislation remains. And I've been reading outlines of that today in CCH and other areas that seem to agree with that view of the world. Basically, to be able to enter a workplace, first of all, as a union official, you've got to have a permit, you've got to be a fit and proper person, there's a definition of that. You may have limits on it if you've got a bad track record, and that only happens in Western Australia, trust us. People in Western Australia, and with all due respect, on Western Australia, you're essentially going to two reasons, to hold discussions with employees, and also to investigate also suspected breaches. There was big concerns, of course. One of the big issues around the legislation was that union officials would be going to be able to inspect the records not only of their members, where their members have asked to come and look and there's been a suspected breach, but also of non-members, and that has a consequence of changes to legislation in the Senate in that regard, so that didn't occur. They can inspect non-members' records with the permission of the non-member if that's helping the case of the member, it's a bit complicated, but there are obviously severe penalties imposed on any official who may divulge any information because they're acting contrary to privacy laws. So in essence, the summary of the rule is that the right of entry, maybe to review this, the right of entry provisions for union officials haven't changed that much from their choices, save for the right to be able to have discussions with employers who are members or potential members of the union, and the right to investigate suspected breaches of
legislation. Thank you. So, from an employer's perspective, any difference to that?
Thank you. Thank you, Kay. I think I agree with Mark that substantially the rights have not changed. It's probably worth spelling them out a little more clearly, however. There are really two sets of rights. There are industrial rights and there are occupational health and safety rights. Looking at the industrial rights, the significant change there goes to right of entry to hold discussions with members or people who are eligible to be members of the union. And that is more likely to be a problem for a large company than a small company. The implication of that is that for some workplaces there may be a union which has not typically had a presence in the workplace but does have coverage under its rules, coming into a workplace legitimately to hold discussions with people who are eligible to be its members. As I said, I think that's going to be an issue for some companies, but they'll tend to be large companies. For the bulk of employers, I'm not sure that's going to make a great difference. The reason I separated out industrial rights and occupational health and safety rights is that it is important to remember that in New South Wales and in many of the other states, but not all states, unions also have right of entry under the State Occupational Health and Safety Act. That's true in New South Wales, and where you are a federal system employer, it is true for those employers as well. There are the rights, by and large, for a union official entering to investigate a suspected breach of the Occupational Health and Safety Act or the regulations are those in the Occupational Health and Safety Act rather than the Federal Act. But the official is still required, if requested by the employer on entry, to show a federal permit as well as a state permit for those types of entry.
Right, before we get a legal, Mark, do you have any...
I was going to say, to be short, there will be unions going into workplaces to hold discussions with potential members, but going back to my original point about this legislation of rights vesting in the individuals, I mean, people want them there to have a discussion. That's the issue. There's no forcing people to go and have discussions with unions. They don't desire.
Right. And can I just ask, Mark, if the union wants to come in and have discussions, can it interrupt work time? Can
no.
it... Right. Okay. Joy Dick, and legal side?
Well, I actually will give a non-legal answer because I think Mark and Dick have accurately stated what the position is. All I would say about this issue is that whether you're talking about right of entry or industrial action, on paper, very little, if anything, has changed. But if you look at the reality of what is starting to happen and what is going to continue to happen, there are enormous changes. And I'll, if you just bear with me, I'll explain what I'm talking about. Under Work Choices, the reality was that the union movement, with great respect to them, was rendered impotent. There was very little that could be done. The legislative framework for them to action anything at a particular workplace, marshal an industrial campaign, get the enthusiasm for that amongst its membership, was severely limited. So, to the rank and file employee who either is a union member or is considering whether they should join a union member, if they've got a union official who's coming once every month or quarter and saying, oh, you really should join up to the union and, you know, help us out, complete this survey, I would understand that rank and file employee saying, well, what's going to happen if I do? What can you really do to change my terms and conditions? And the answer to that question, I think, if the union official was answering it truthfully, would have to have been very little. That has changed enormously since the introduction of the Fair Work Act, for reasons that have already been alluded to by both Mark and Dick around the good faith bargaining laws. Because the union official can now answer that question, I think, by saying, we can improve your terms and conditions because your employer has to talk to us if under these new good faith bargaining laws. And if they don't talk to us, there are consequences for them in not talking to us. And we can utilise the legislation to force that employer to respond to our proposals, meet with us, consider our requests. Sure, they don't have to necessarily agree with us, but we can put a lot of pressure on them. And all we need from you is some support. And why wouldn't the union official utilise that strategy? It's completely valid, it's not illegal. In fact, the law facilitates and encourages that. So as part and parcel of that process, whether you're talking about that union official wanting to come onto site more regularly and more people being interested in meeting with that union official, that paradigm has shifted enormously. So yes, on paper, the technical details of what the union official has to do to come on site has not changed, but the real politic of what's going on in the workplace has changed. So right of entry is something that is going to become more and more relevant, and I'd say exactly the same thing about industrial action. Industrial action, yes, there are tough new rules that have been retained, as Julia Gillard said, in relation to industrial action. But those rules are on paper. The reality of how industrial campaigns work, and I'm sure Mark would agree with me, is that they're about momentum. And you need a positive, helpful framework if you're a union in order to generate that momentum. And I'm not passing any political comment on this other than to note that that momentum can now be generated, whereas for the last 3 or 4 years, and some might say for the last 13 years, that momentum couldn't be. So I think on those two issues we need to look beyond what's on paper to actually the reality of what's going to go, what has already started to happen and what we'll continue to see happen. I'm sure someone might like to respond to that.
I think, Mark, what George is saying here is the union movement is a business like any other. And I guess if you cut to the chase, what he's probably saying is that the legislation is allowing you to increase your business. Would you agree?
Well, he said that work choice is made evident. So by definition, the new legislation is given us by Anglo or something, I didn't quite understand it. But
that's quite
without a doubt that it's clear that there's certain right to collective bargaining. No doubt. It's the first time in this country we've ever had collective bargaining rights. But in practice, simply the reverse applies when you talk about what's going to happen in practice. Just what that is, even if you've got the best laws in the world, to get a collective agreement up in a situation where previously there hasn't been a collective agreement. It takes a lot of work from a union to get enough workers in the enterprise, any union, who want to bargain, and so manage a sustained bargaining campaign, then you've got to keep that campaign going while you've got negotiations on. Then, allegedly, if the negotiations break down, you've got to consider taking industrial action. That's another ballot you've got to conduct amongst the workers to take that action. And in a predominantly service sector economy, where most workers are white-collar workers, they're not used to taking industrial action, nor do they want to take industrial action. They're in operational jobs where they don't have the time to take industrial action. But, you know, we're not a blue-collar, industrialised economy anymore. And when you think about your typical union member, the average member of the public will think about someone in a boiler suit or holding a hammer. A member of the construction, one of the construction unions or one of the manufacturing unions. Your modern day unionist is most likely female, most likely a teacher or a nurse, and likely to work in the public sector. And it's not the same old, knock them down, drag them out style of industrial relations in this country, regardless of what the legislation says.
Okay, as much as I'm sure everyone will save other questions for question time, which is fast approaching, unfortunately, there are probably some other things we need to cover. Probably the next one, which again affects a lot of small businesses, the reasonable tests that have been brought in by the new legislation. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with these, I will give you an example. If you have a working mother who says that she can only work from 3 o'clock till 2 o'clock and therefore is making a reasonable request to do so. Sorry, 10 till 2, sorry. I'm thinking about what time because I've got to collect my children. Can she, or is she in fact entitled to only work those hours? And the legislation actually says that you have to be reasonable in your response. So, I'll swing this one up to you first.
Sure, one of the national employment standards is the right that employees have to request a change in their working arrangements for caring purposes. Now, interestingly, the caring purposes is not an unlimited definition of caring purposes. It has to be to care for children who are under school age, and school age defined by the relevant state or territory. If a child has a disability, the relevant age is 18. What's interesting about this is that you, as an employer, you have that, so long as you meet the definition of caring purposes, you have the right to request that change. And the onus at that point shifts to your employer, who has the right to refuse it, so long as they've got reasonable business grounds for doing so. Unfortunately, reasonable business grounds, and I think, Kay, this is where you're going with this question, reasonable business grounds is not defined. And some might say, well, that's lawyers looking after lawyers. And that's not a bad thing ever, but I think the reality is that you can't have a one-size-fits-all definition of reasonableness. What is going to be reasonable for a two-employee news agency versus what's going to be reasonable for a large multinational that employs 20,000 people in this country, it's just not a like-for-like comparison. The explanatory memorandum goes into a bit of detail around some examples, and I think employers just have to be very conscious of the fact that the spirit and intent of the legislation is that the employer must try to accommodate that request. A lot of employers, let's not pull any punches, are going to be troubled by that, and employers are going to be inconvenienced by it. This legislation requires employers to embrace higher levels of inconvenience than was previously the case. Mere inconvenience for an employer will not constitute reasonable business grounds. A lot of employers might not like that, it's just what the law is. So a lot of employers are going to have to become a lot more progressive in their views, and I'm saying that not wanting to sound unsympathetic to it. I appreciate the challenge running a business myself. But that's just the times. And there's a lot of good lessons to be learnt and a lot of good success stories for business and individual employees who have properly embraced flexible working arrangements. And I think, you know, legislation that's potentially very polarising, certainly something like this has the potential to polarise, but I actually think that where this is coming from is a very good space, and so long as there's genuine consideration given to those businesses who try and really do try their best to accommodate it but who just can't, I think they deserve to be recognised in it, but as a general rule, it's changed the rules a bit.
Okay, so Dick, over to you. What will happen to a business then, let's say somebody who runs a 30-man business and their receptionist wants to start working from 10 till 2 and the business can't accommodate it? How do you see it working?
Well, I think the industry says there's no set of rules that fit universally. And I guess in the case of a job like a receptionist, to try to reasonably accommodate the need would be to seriously investigate the possibility of job shares, so that you have two people working what is essentially a single job. What is going to happen if it doesn't come about? Well, conceptually, the reasonable arrangements provisions are not enforceable unless other circumstances happen to apply. So on one level, particularly in the introductory days of the National Employment Standards, not too much except the impact that might have in the individual workplace. Over time, I'm sure that will change. I think one of the more important issues that this all raises, because we really are looking at legislation which is requiring employers to try to assess the circumstances of the individual applicant employee and the circumstances of the business, is that it's going to make policies, business policies, workplace policies more complicated. One of the ways this has shown up in other places where this sort of legislation is in existence, which is England, is that over time it becomes increasingly difficult for employers to meet these sorts of applications. That accommodating the first couple of requests is easier than accommodating the third request or the 15th request. So it becomes very difficult, even in an area like this, where you might have numbers of employees with child care responsibilities, to accommodate like requests because of the imposition it's increasingly putting on the business.
On the other hand, of course, that also affects the employees who are both being accommodated and those who, for whom accommodation is being refused. So that one of the less obvious features about this right, which is not here at the moment but will be from the 1st of January, is that it really is a difficult management challenge over time, as well as initially when early requests might come in.
So Mark, over to you. I guess a question I have as a working mother who owns a fairly large business, one of the things that I see wrong with this particular piece of legislation is that employers will stop hiring women. So what do you see from a union perspective?
Because of the reason I see you.
Well, yeah, I mean, women are more likely to use this piece of legislation than anyone else. Yeah, absolutely. So
I don't think it's the case, silly, at the moment. We've got an economic downturn. As soon as the economy picks up, there's no doubt that this country should continue to strive. We have to have more participation in our workforce, which means we have to make sure we have more women, continue to increase the rate of participation of women in our workforce, as we have over the last 20 or 30 years. I think that's one of the great success stories of this country, how we've managed to grow our workforce and have high participation rates from women in the workforce. It's a difficult issue, and it's, I agree with Joy Deep and Dick, it's as seen in the eyes of a particular beholder at the time of a particular enterprise with particular circumstances that they're confronted with. I take exception to Kay that there's a lot of males that have to deal with family issues.
My husband being one of them.
And me, myself. I was tossing up whether I could get here tonight because my wife got stuck at work with her. You know, it happens all the time. And so I don't think in that regard it should be seen through sort of gender eyes. What I find interesting is we're all, and right so, patting ourselves on the back as a nation that our unemployment rate hasn't risen as high as it has, as we anticipated. One of the reasons is because there's been arrangements made about reductions in working hours. Now, it's preferable in most cases to that people be made redundant. And I think that shows that as a community and as in the workplaces there is, we can work together reasonably. So I think that shows a lot of hope when it comes to tests such as this, that we can work through it. But the law just can't dictate in prescriptive terms every particular circumstance that it considers to be reasonable, and it will have to be somewhat subjective.
So you think the unions will be fairly flexible when it comes to this particular piece of the legislation? Because it is opening up a little bit of a can of worms, you'd have to agree. So,
well, yes, but I think notions of reasonableness have been around for a long time in the law and in the employment law in various different ways, and thus by unfair dismissals, fair go around notions about what happened was reasonable. So the notion of reasonableness is something that has to be considered in the employment relationship that's been around for a long time. So this is just another area where it has to be applied, and we will deal with it as circumstances arise on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you. We're now going to question time. I'm sorry, we have some other subjects, but we've run out of time. Are there any questions from the audience?
Being cut back in different countries. So we're going to be prescriptive about kind of where we should take things. So what I'm asking is, do you see this affecting unemployment over the next 2, 3, 4 years? Because one of the big things about work choices was that it did increase full-time occupation. Full-time jobs increased enormously. So what's the long-term view for all of this? What
do you think? I'll just start because I'm sort of, I guess, in the middle. As I'm in recruitment and I also own a business. I started my business 19 years ago. I've been in recruitment now for 23 years. 23 years ago, it was not unusual for an employer to ring up and say, I want a blonde with big boobs. I don't even care if she's type. That was not rare. That changed over the years, but can I say probably for the first time in the last 12 months, we're starting to see employers ringing up saying, I want women of this age group. And it is happening. And as much as... And look, as I said before, I've had 2 children, and I'm the last person who would discriminate against women in the workforce. The majority of the women that I employ are all of childbearing age. But yeah, it's happening, and this sort of legislation will make it happen. No matter how much the politicians want to stand up and say, we're going to get on our Bible and say it's not going to happen, it will happen. People are running businesses. They want to know that they're safe. That's my view.
Oh. Well, I think a lot of it will be driven by money. The fact is that as the population ages, you might have as many older people. Well, first of all, I think older people are discriminated against when it comes to work, and that we should be looking at increasing the level of participation of people beyond the age of 55 and working up to 65, 70, who knows? I mean, the average retirement age at the present time is 58, way too low. With a lot of skills we've lost to this workplace. And one of the things I've taken up with my union colleagues, if I could just digress for a moment, is during the last recession in 91, a lot of men lost their jobs, and they were predominantly men in manufacturing, over the age of 45, and never came back into the workforce full time. And that's a tragedy, not just for them, but as I say, for the community at large, because it's a big skill base we've lost. Hopefully this risk downturn is more cyclical rather than structural change, and that when the economy picks up, people will come back into the workforce. But it seems to me that in certain areas there are certain skill shortages that just have to be filled, whether male, female, old, young, and you just got to pick who's out there. By contrast, Kay, my wife, works for an engineering firm down the road here. She's a lawyer there. They recently employed 2 young women as accountants in their 20s. And they threw everything at them to keep them, because they've given them office of attorney leave, they've given them GM memberships, they've given all sorts of things because there's such a shortage of accounts they need to keep. So I think as time passes, you'll find that more women are coming, more will be needed in the workforce, and will be encouraged to stay regardless of what other wives or little wives they may have.
Can I just ask, I mean, being here,
have
you 35 years, and there's no one to do the job now. So the government from Great Tabor put in schools where you have girls that are very intelligent and men that are industrial designers and whatever they bring out here from other countries to learn to be hairdressers. They've got no intention of being a hairdresser. So this is in place. Who is going to be doing our trade? We can run an ad for 2 months, 3 months and not get any of them. So learn the rest. And we're talking about, like, it's too physical, so they can't stay on the legs. There's all the diet on the way to drop them. What's going to happen? We all stop doing it. We'll stop going to the hair.
Well, again, the whole area, I think, of skilled migration here, and it's going to take us all night about how we fill those sorts of jobs. But that's the case in point, that there are scarcity in certain jobs, and regardless of who you are or what you are, if you're prepared to do the job, employers will take you on. And that's the other challenge that we have, is when we make sure that people can participate in the workforce throughout their working years, that there are certain physical jobs that people can't maintain until they're 55 or 60, and how do they transition into new work?
So there's significant structural change, and it won't happen overnight. What sort of time frame are we looking at?
Well, I don't know that some of these changes are happening now. I mean, but in certain professions now, there's lots of skill shortages. My sister runs a physiotherapy business and having to bring people over from overseas because of skill shortages. The accountants and hairdressers, there's lots of skill shortages at the moment that we're having to fill. And that's why I say that regardless of what the rules is, people will just have to employ people, male, female, or different, because they need the skills and they need to fill them.
Isn't that bypassing the issue that was being questioned, though, how small businesses would afford to employ these people? Okay, we can bring in people from overseas. This is very, you know, that's a good solution, maybe. But they still have to be paid for with these conditions. And I think that's
Sorry, they're still going to have to be paid for under what conditions, as in...
If you have to employ people under certain conditions and allow for...
flexibility of work.
Flexibility in the workplace, yeah?
Yeah. Flexibility, it costs money.
Absolutely.
And that's the question I don't think you're addressing.
Absolutely. And if you bring someone in and sponsor them under permanent residency, you will have to guarantee them employment for 3 years.
And they're all, you know, like, maybe small businesses, can small businesses afford that?
Well, let me just go back to the first question. If we have to bring in people from overseas, if there's a shortage, you just have to bring people in from overseas. That's not a factor of new legislation, international legislation.
No,
the change of nature, our economy, and skill shortages and things of that nature. I agree there are some issues about legislation and conditions that have to be met. I don't know if people from small business can better tell me the sort of costs that may add to their business, but you know, they have to make a judgment call about whether do the cost benefit analysis of whether they employ people under those conditions to make sure their business can run. You must remember there are lots of union members who are small business, but they're independent contractors, in particularly in the transport area, and they tell us some of the issues and some of the concerns.
Can I ask, just point out, that the all the issues that we've discussed tonight are not special to Australia.
No.
So my question comes up, what did we learn, or the drafters of the Fair Work Legislation, what countries, if any, did they go to find out their experiences? And what country did they find had best, both in productivity and relationship between management and unions, and what country was the worst?
Start in the US, then in Canada, then over to Sweden, Norway, and there's an amount of a number of different systems. But they're basically in the Nordic countries in Europe, you know, they work on a cooperative model. This has been going back to the Dutch 101 at University of New South Wales in 1978, but the cooperative model that you have in countries such as Sweden and also in the rest of Europe. I think it'd be fair to say that the Fair Work legislation is really based on a bit of a hybrid of the United States model, which is good faith bargaining principles, and also the UK model with its focus on voluntary bargaining and basic employment rights that Dick was alluding to. That's what's happening now in the UK, that these individual rights and employment rights now that exist under our new legislation are very much based on the UK model. I think some of my colleagues, that if we're looking to, for examples and for experience and to talk to people about the legislation and how it might work in practice, look to the United Kingdom as opposed to the USA, because the USA is very much an adversarial system, whereas the UK model is very much world bargaining. What should occur in the first place on a voluntary basis, and then if there is a falling out between the parties, then you revert to the legal system.
Which of them has shown success whatever their system is, in productivity.
Well, again, that's a talent versus strength. Look, in the short term, of course, the US has not had a great track record recently in terms of productivity improvement as opposed to Europe. But then if you go back to the 1950s and start measuring it from the 1950s, you'd say the United States is still ahead of the rest of the other countries, and the other countries in recent times, the other developed nations have sort of caught up with them. So I can't give you a simplistic answer on that, because productivity goes beyond just industrial laws, involves human capital, involves skills, innovation, a whole range of issues leading us to improve productivity.
I work for a large multinational. I thought the statement was any person, any work for anybody can demand to have negotiation with their employer, is that what was said? Or a request to have a negotiation. So I should get Ted here as my representative and go to IBM and say I want to negotiate my conditions.
I wouldn't do that.
You have a nice photo though.
I think in principle the answer is yes. In practice, if IBM disbelieves that you are voicing the views of a majority of its employees, it could tell you that it doesn't want to negotiate. If it's wrong about that, it could be required to negotiate.
So it doesn't have to negotiate with the people, it has to negotiate with a significant proportion.
I think individual can have their own.
The focus of the system is that there won't be negotiation for statutory agreements for individuals. It is a collective bargaining system. The nature of your fellow employees will rather depend on the type of work that's being done and the geographical dispersion and things like that.
Just a very quick question. I'll go back to the very first. You've had a court case, case today. I, unfortunately, as an employer, fell under the very old system and got taken to the cleaners, I guess, by an employee. My very last employee, I have to tell you. I now do the work myself and became a small employer, just me. But if I was to employ anyone and the person wasn't satisfactory, am I able to, with some ease, without having the three meetings and the whatevers, say you're no longer employed? On the other hand, as I do now, if I need a job done, I get somebody to come in and contract it. And so I don't employ them from... They just come in, do whatever, and that's it. Is that still a good option for a very small employer? Or am I still sitting in that category where it's really hard to get rid of somebody who is not doing the job, like it was in the old days, the bad days?
Look, I'm conscious of the time. I guess dealing with the second question first, can you still bring people on contract, genuine contractors? Absolutely, and the situation you have is there's only so much that you can do yourself, like so many people in your situation will have to decide. Dick alluded to the fact that there's a small business fee dismissal code. Now, that is designed to assist small businesses to get their processes right, and if you follow that, the theory is that you should be fairly safe. But, employing people is always a gamble, and hearing a lot of the discussion about what employers are going to do or not going to do in the face of this new legislation, I think we can spend a lot of time talking about what the laws do and don't do. The reality is that whether you're an employer or an employee, there's certain fundamentals that don't change. As an employer, you've got to run a business. You've got to get people to help you to do what needs to be done. Now, whatever the legal framework is, that just has to be complied with. You can choose not to comply with it, but that has consequences. In terms of from an employee's perspective, you come to work, you do a job, you offer a value proposition to your employer, your work is scrutinised, assessed, valued, rewarded, the same way that employers have to offer a value proposition to their people. They need to be treated fairly, they need to be fairly rewarded, incentivated, and then I think we often lose sight of that fact. So I'd like to think that, yes, the flexible working arrangements and whatever, initially it'll take us a while to get used to that, but I'm actually reasonably confident that after a while it'll just become part and parcel of the employer's psyche. And whether it's teething problems or not, we've got a long way to go before we get there, but hopefully we do get there.
Can I just say one thing based on the question about contractors? We've just had a very recent case with a very large bank, and thank goodness this all happened to them on May the 30th and not the 2nd of July. If you are going to hire a contractor of any sorts, you need to make sure that you do specify to them they are a contractor and they have a fixed contract period. And if you use an agency, ensure that the agency is making that specification and make a request from the agency that you see the email that goes to that person to say you are employed as a temp or you are employed as a contractor. Because the one thing this new legislation, and without prolonging the proceedings, the one thing this new legislation does do is open up a massive can of worms if you have temps and contractors. And you need to make sure that that is in writing. You are a temp or you are a contractor and you're on a fixed term.
Sorry, can I just make 2 points of closing on the table? In terms of unions and their rights, your opening remarks about the Fair Work Ombudsman, you read out what sort of prosecutions they've been undertaking. That shows a problem for unions. It's good that the Ombudsman's out there. But if you sort of think that means that the role of enforcement of unions that traditionally played has been undertaken to a large degree by the regulator, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but that's a reality. And also make another prediction, given spoke about all night about the rights of the individual in this legislation. I reckon in this country within the next 5 years you'll see a union member sue their union for not representing them properly. And that's what's happening in the United Kingdom. It's happened. It has happened already in the United Kingdom, and they will sue their union for not respecting their representational rights. So that's why I say there's dangers in this legislation for unions, the big dangers.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've just had words of wisdom from four very knowledgeable and respected peers in their field who generously donated their time. Please, let's all show off. Thank you. I noticed there are quite a few people here tonight who are making notes, and I think we all got a lot out of it. If you weren't taking notes or you couldn't take notes quickly enough, we do have, is it Maggie? Maggie at the back, is it? No. Who's up there with those books?
Janet,
sorry. We've got Janet up there. She's got a couple of books. One is called Fair Work, The New Workplace Laws and the Work Choices Legacy. And there's another one called Steward's Guide to Employment Law, second edition. Both of those books can be ordered off Janet tonight, and pay for them tonight and they'll be sent out to you. So if you're interested in some books, please see Janet. I'm very grateful to Robin Hughes, the principal of North Sydney Boys High School, for allowing us to use this venue. You know, it was very nice to see the lads here from the school, representing the school. Welcome, fellows, and I hope you enjoyed it. And it also helped us set up, which was pretty wonderful. I feel very proud that the Rugby Club of North Sydney Sunrise, it's a very small club actually, initiated this meeting, and thank President Ken past President Ken Prenshaw, and two relatively new Rotarians, Anne Henderson and Yvonne Howard, for organising the event. Anne and Yvonne have amazed me with their energy and capability, as they were born to be Rotarians, I'm sure. Rotary is a worldwide organisation of business people who want to help make this world a better place. Ours is, as I said, a relatively small club that meets Piatta restaurant Tuesday mornings and for breakfast, and we'd love to see you there. Tuesday mornings, Piatta was 123 Blues Point Road, McMahon's Point. We ask anyone who's the least bit interested in learning more about Rotary to take one of our Humanity in Motion magazines with you. It gives a very broad picture of what Rotary is up to in our district, which stretches from north of the harbour all the way to the Central Coast. You are all now invited to stay for drinks and nibblies. Please talk to the Rotarians here this evening and consider joining us at a meeting. Rotary needs men and women just like you. Thank you.